clamps that would do that. And the fact that we were using unpressed panels without the high hydraulic pressure made it quite easy for us to go in there with screws. So these panels were really just hanging onto that frame. They were not load bearing, and they were very easy to fasten on. And when we had joints or cracks, we developed this plastic putty that we could seal up the joints.
You made your own plastic putty?
Yeah. And then we heated it with infrared lamps.
I see. And so that, in effect, joined the panels together.
It set them up and fused them together.
Right.
And then, of course, we had to do some handwork, sanding to smooth it over.
Smooth it over. Now, I've often wondered about the painting. It looks like it's white.
Yellow. It was a
Oh, no, that's right. I've heard it was bright yellow, right?
Well, it was off between yellow and white.
Sort of an oyster?
Yeah. Well, it was definitely yellow, but it wasn't, you know, too splashy.
Now, who decided on that color?
Gee, I don't know.
Did you paint it?
We had it, we painted it up there in the
It was hand painted or sprayed?
Sprayed.
It was sprayed in the engineering library garage.
I remember Lowell and I, we were debating what to do about the radiator decoration. And we finally came up with
a hood ornament?
Yeah. Well, no, if you notice that we had the vertical strips that
we realized
we could, those were being used somewhere in production. Those are, they were extruded plastic. They were plastic.
Oh, plastic.
Dark brown plastic.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So we just got some of that and cut it off to the right size and fastened them to the...
You found them somewhere in the automotive?
Yeah. They were used in somewhere in the Rouge plant. I've forgotten how we found them. But that settled that problem. We didn't want to have to build a special grill mold and fool around that way.
So you just adhered them to the front of the radiator?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was one of the first cars that never didn't have a running board, too.
That's right. I guess the Zephyr had pioneered it, Lincoln Zephyr.
But
very few others had.
That's right.
And that was deliberate.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Because you didn't want to try
attach
a running board to the to the plastic panels, even though you probably could have if it would have been running
It was...
Too much stress. So.
From then on, all automotive design was away from running boards from that time on.
Now, you mentioned earlier that that these preforms, since they were not hydraulically compressed, would not stand much stress.
Well, they were they were quite rigid. They were surprisingly strong. But we could have made them stronger with the pressure.
Now, you also obviously, forgive me, you also fashioned an interior that was very reasonably close to the production Ford at the time. Did you use the standard seats and cushions?
Yeah, I don't think we didn't finish off the rear seat.
You didn't?
We had a standard front seat, and three people could sit in it. Because I took the car home for a couple of weeks. My kids would drive it at night.
Well, now, you're going too fast for me. So, again, Mr. Ford decided to have some publicity shots taken, and there are several which are still in existence. One showing Mr. Overly at the wheel without a hat. Tell me about the windshield. How did you fashion the windshield? Or the glass? Or did you have a windshield?
Oh, yeah, we had a windshield.
Was it made out of glass, or was it made out of...
No, it was glass. Well, wait. Gee, I don't know. There were two showings of this car. One was at a special Dearborn Day event, which they had it, I guess, once every year.
Mm-hmm.
And in a little park down...
Ford Field. No?
Well, I'm not sure where Ford Field is, but...
Well, that's in the middle of Dearborn.
Well, this might be it was a public park.
Yeah.
And that probably was George Ebeling, but maybe some news reporters were there too.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when the Michigan State Fair in August of that year was where we we really showed it then. It was featured out there.
August of 1941. 41, okay. That was the real public exposure.
Yeah, that's why we put the license plate, you see, it's 1941.
Right, exactly. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the Michigan State Fair, I remember because they had a Japanese MiG fighter that had been shot down, and it was right next to us. Now, that was before Pearl Harbor.
Good heavens. How did they get it?
I don't know.
September of 41.
I can't recall. I remember vividly that.
Okay.
That
fine. Not a MiG, you mean a Zero.
Zero.
Yeah. Mm, right. In any event, what sort of reception did it get at the fair? And were you out there every day or so?
Well, I didn't attend the booth or anything like that.
No.
But
okay.
And I'm not sure Lowell was out there either.
But you would go out occasionally, both of you. To start.
We had attendance out there, of course.
Yeah. But we got an awfully lot of national press recognition.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was strictly handmade, but it proved the point.
But it was drivable.
Oh yeah.
You
oh sure.
You drove it home.
Oh yeah.
And you took the kids and your wife for rides.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Boyer remembers vividly riding in the...
Well, that was...
I'm not the president.
But then Mrs.
We've
Boyer...
We've only been married 20 years.
Then Mrs. Boyer remembers... would remember.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So there you are. You've got this drivable model. It's very very much a... the publicity is tremendous. Mr. Ford is pleased with the reception it got.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was he pleased with the final model? He indicated that
you guys
had done a good job.
Yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh.
He was proud to show it off.
Yes, he was. Uh-huh. So the thought was at that time, as indicated in articles that I've read, that what was he planning for the plastic climber? What was his basic aim?
Again, to provide industrial markets for farmers, we knew we had an awful lot of work to do to make it economically to compete with steel.
Right, you hadn't really whipped that problem, had you?
Not really for intricate designs. Mm-hmm. The rear trunk lid was relatively easy.
Right, mm-hmm.
But when you get into the more curvature mm-hmm. designs, it would have been.
That was your big problem was to curve it under pressure.
Right, but we knew we were going to have to stack it.
Mm-hmm.
And
as you had.
And if you have a deep draw or a curve, mm-hmm. you would be limited as to how high you could stack it.
Of course, yes.
So it was going to be a tough problem.
Uh-huh.
But as I say, the war solved all that for us. She's going to get it in the bedroom.
But before the war started, this is in the fall of. Of 41, Mr. Ford is gung-ho about you and other Mr. Overly and others going ahead with your research to try to solve this problem of shaping it for into a recognizable automobile
right.
form.
Mm-hmm. along at the same time, though,
yes.
the war fever was dominating everybody's thought.
That midsummer was a very hectic.
And he sent me out to Los Angeles, and I visited every large airplane manufacturer see how, if we could do anything in producing planes from structural plastic.
The plastic industry was really just getting started, in effect, was it?
Well, yeah. Howard Hughes had built a single-seater fighter-type plane, completely out of plywood, and he had bent the plywood enough to make the shape of a wing and everything.
Under heat.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And the idea was to see whether we could use our technology and produce parts for the planes.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along in that area, Mr. Ford had a visit from General Hap Arnold, who was head of the Air Force.
Right, H.H. Arnold.
Yeah, and they were having lunch down at the Rouge plant, in the Rouge dining room this day.
Was that in 41, mid-41?
In that area,
uh-huh.
Because he sent for me. And Jimmy Doolittle was there too.
Uh-huh.
And they'd been discussing the possible use of plastics in airplanes.
Uh-huh. Had airplanes had any plastic interiors or components at all?
Other than the plexiglass.
Okay, and some bakelite possibly.
Well, yeah, a little stuff.
But yeah, okay.
Nothing structural.
Right.
So they sent for me, and Arnold said, "Do you think you could make a wing out of a plastic?" I said, "We can make the shape. I don't know how strong or tough we can make it for you." He said, "Well, why don't we give you a research contract and build a few for us?" Okay. So they.
And Mr. Boyd, of course, was agreeable.
Oh yeah, he wanted us to go gung ho on it.
All right.
So we got a research contract from Wright Field. I don't know, $100,000 or something like that, to build one wing of a fighter plane. Just one wing is all we had to do.
One airfoil, in effect.
That's right. Uh-huh. And we built it with this technique, mm-hmm. and got it down there, and they tortured it, put it through the testing, and.
But how did you curve it? Obviously, you wanted an aerodynamic curve.
Well, we built a mold for the wing tip,
uh-huh.
and I took that down to Wright Field, and that's where we tested it.
Uh-huh.
And the Young's modulus is the key to that. That's the stiffness, in effect.
Is that named after the man that
it's
formulated
a physics, it? Law of physics, and Young developed it.
Uh-huh. And what's it called? Modulus?
Young's modulus.
How do you spell it, please?
M-O-D-U-L-U-S.
Okay.
I'm a little hazy on the technical aspects of it, but in effect, it's a measure of stiffness to weight. That's one reason why they use aluminum instead of some other material in airplanes, because
okay.
aluminum has a pretty high Young's modulus.
Uh-huh.
But we were even higher
for
weight.
Mm-hmm.
To,
sure.
To,
sure.
But we, the impact strength was a little low.
Talking about air?
Yeah.
Not projectiles, but air.
Well, upon impact, they wanted to be, we were too stiff. We fractured instead of give, whereas aluminum will give a little.
Yeah, right.
And we were working on that.
Uh-huh.
But we finally built a complete wing, and they tested it, and it wasn't quite strong enough, wasn't what they really wanted. But we did the contract, we finished the contract.
What sort of stress analysis would they put it under?
Well, they had all kinds of testing machines down there. They could put bending strength was one of their keys. They put a load in the middle of it and measure deflection and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's just
how about its durability? Would they try to crush it or smash it? Wouldn't that be a problem?
Yeah, they did. They actually destroyed it.
You passed most of the tests.
Yeah, if. I don't know what would have happened if we'd gone on, and I don't know why we quit, except everything stopped there at 1943. I'm a little bit hazy now as to what.
But you finished out the contract.
Oh yeah.
Was it durable enough to stop a bullet?
No.
No. But it would in normal air pressure, it would have deflected without
yeah.
breaking up.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And you could bend it to make it a aerodynamic.
Well, of course, we could have. Money was no object to the Air Force. They'd have built us any kind of press we wanted if we could get an article that was satisfactory.
Uh-huh. But it wasn't quite satisfactory.
No, it needed a lot more work.
It did. Yeah. But the contract came to the end. To an end.
Yeah, and it just wasn't pursued.
Was Arnold pleased with what you? Done,
well, I don't know whether
Force,
he ever heard.
I mean, the Air Force people at Wright.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They were pleased with the.
Yeah, they were the ones that oversaw all of those
right.
types of contracts.
Right.
They had a lot of research contracts. And
I'm sure they did.
And,
this is just one of them.
It's just one little dinky one, yeah.
Uh-huh. But it was an important one.
Well, it could have been.
It presaged a tremendous boom after the war in that kind of product, even during the war.
Right.
Yeah. But at the time, you thought it was just another research.
I think we were a little heavy, too.
Ah, okay.
And I think
where it lies you.
That's right, yeah. That was the trouble with Howard Hughes' plane. He had inch thick plywood, and it was strong enough, but it was too heavy.
Was that later to become the spruce goose material?
Some of that technology was used in that.
Huh?
That was pretty heavy too.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought plywood could be reduced to a rather light, a light substance, at least today.
Well, it can.
Not in those days.
It can.
Yeah. A thin but durable substance.
Mm-hmm. The mosquito bomber in England was all plywood.
Of course, yeah. They won't take no. Wasn't Iron Mountain doing? Were they still doing regular wood doors on their station wagons, or were they working? I don't think they worked with plywood, or at least bonded wood, until after the war, did they?
I never was up to Iron Mountain. I don't know. The only station wagons I saw were just wood, not plywood.
Bonded wood. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, good. So the Air Force contract comes to an end, and what year is this? 42? You've gotten it back in the fall of 41, and it was a 6 or 12 month contract.
It was in that area. I can't pinpoint the exact date.
Now, of course, you were doing other projects at the soybean plant. What other projects were you working on besides the plastic panels?
Well, on the fiber, of course, that was a big one, but we had quite a...
Excuse me. I'm sorry, let me back up a moment. Except for yourself, of course, and the people who read the plastic journals at the time of your experiment, it's a commonly held assumption, and I find this all the time with people writing and calling me, that those panels you made were made out of soybean.
Yeah, that's not true.
Can you back up and give us the composition, as I think you have partly throughout our interview, the exact composition of those panels?
Well, we had several alternative formulas, but basically they were phenol formaldehyde resin.
Right, which was the basic bonding agent.
Right, for the fiber.
Flax, the Ramey,
for the
hemp,
structural fiber.
The heavy agricultural fiber products that you used for the, and it was the phenol formaldehyde resin that held it together. Okay, good. Fine.
And of course gave it waterproofness.
Yes, there were no other elements in that.
Well, there were several resins that we tried. For instance, urea formaldehyde was pretty good, but it was more expensive.
Uh-huh.
And resorcinol to take the place of phenol, and there are a lot of resorcinal.
That was tried in place of phenol.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We were always, phenol was relatively expensive in those days. And
what
we
was
were
its derivative you've mentioned?
Coal tar.
Coal tar. Mm-hmm. It's a distillate.
Off of coke ovens.
A distillate of the coke ovens. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which you had plenty of right next door, yeah. Did you not? You could get all you wanted, didn't you?
Well, they didn't produce much. Ford, the coke ovens were mainly producing ammonium sulfate.
Oh, I see.
And the benzol.
Benzol, yes.
Ford benzol.
Yeah, oh, gosh, that's another whole story. Yeah. Were you ever involved in that?
No.
No, okay, good. Yeah. That was a light oil derivative of the coke making process,
right.
Wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as a distillate, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you tried several compounds, but the phenol
formaldehyde
seemed to be the best one. Mm-hmm. The best bond.
Now, that, in those days, that was before glass fiber really was available.
The Libby Owens Ford people hadn't really come up with that.
Not yet. They were working on it.
And
they were making mineral wool
from
slag and that sort of thing, but they hadn't come out with a real good fiber yet.
Uh-huh.
Now today the Chevrolet
Corvette
is made out of...
Completely out of fiberglass.
Well, that's fiberglass.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And that, they get pretty good strength with that.
But that process was strictly in the laboratory at the time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't feasible yet.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So so what were you... So it's been fairly successful, and you've excited the world press, and especially the industry press is very is fascinated,
mm-hmm.
and several technical articles are written in the plastics industry press. And you've worked with the Air Force, and now where are you at this juncture? Say, sometime in 1942. Are you going to plug into the war effort in any other way?
Well, we got involved out of Willow Run.
How did that happen?
Well, they wanted somebody to oversee the plexiglass that went into the bombers.
Now, is this a new, or was this a new process developed by the glass industry?
No, plexiglass was available commercially.
It was?
Yeah.
Before the war?
Yeah.
Okay. And what were its uses?
Oh, mostly the decorative stuff when it first came out, but finally they developed transparent panels, like glass.
Which would take the place of glass?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's what they used them for in the bombers. They so bombed
didn't
gun
shatter,
turrets.
It didn't shatter dangerously like glass would if a bullet
right.
hit it. Okay, good.
But it...
But it was translucent, obviously.
It was, yeah,
transparent. Transparent.
Until they landed in the B-24s, which we made at
Willow Run. Yeah.
They'd get them over to North Africa.
Ah.
And take one takeoff and one landing in the sand.
Oh.
And they couldn't see out of the...
It would be so pitted that their vision
would... They'd have to put a new one on every time.
And that was terrible. Oh. Expensive.
Oh, it was terrible.
So what did you work on that problem?
No, I didn't. I was involved in protecting it while I was in the Willow Run plant.
Protecting the compounds.
The plexiglass and everything.
Right.
And we could get them installed on the bomber, and uh-huh. but then they'd fly them away, and that's the last we ever heard of.
Of course,
we heard about the problem, but
there were several desert theaters where they.
Oh yeah. The B-24 was used in North Africa quite a lot.
It was their mainstay. Right?
Mm-hmm. I suppose the Boeing B-17s had the same problem.
But they were used largely in Europe.
Yeah,
they
weren't in the
sand.
Mm-hmm.
So were you involved in this in the sense that you?
We didn't know work on trying.
How did they ever come up with a compound that would resist a sand pit? Did they?
I don't think they did.
They never did.
Today
they keep replacing them. Huh?
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. So you were over there working on the plexiglass windshields for the B-24.
That was that was my war stint there.
Uh-huh, mm-hmm. Good. And that lasted how long?
Well, till everything folded up there.
So
and
Edsel Ford died.
Yeah.
Right. And that was a very traumatic event.
It was an
event in the Ford Motor Company and the Ford family.
In the family, yeah.
What practical consequences were there in terms of your project?
I don't follow you.
Oh, step by step. Edsel Ford had been ailing for a couple of years, and he then died in spring of 1943 of what was later diagnosed as stomach cancer.
Yeah.
And this has a profound effect on Mr. Ford.
Right.
And how did it affect your operation?
Well, I knew somehow or other. I knew that we were going to stop all of our operations there.
You had a premonition of this.
Well, not only that, but the Air Force made no bones about wanting our building.
Oh, I see. This is the point where the Pratt Whitney people want that air-conditioned laboratory on Oakland Boulevard. Okay.
And at the same time, also the Internal Revenue was complaining.
Why
that
were they unhappy?
Because we were doing post-war work on this fiber work
for
a profit for the Ford Motor Company. And doing it in a tax-free plant.
Which was, of course, Greenville Village.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they said, you can't do that. You have to stop all civilian work or all work that might lead to a profit.
In a non-profit.
It could upset the whole Edison Institute organization.
Okay, good. You'd have to start paying taxes.
That's right.
Right, okay.
And so all of these things hit at once.
And it had catastrophic effect on your operation.
And I had just about decided, well, hey, there's one other factor.
Yes.
My wife became ill.
Ah.
And the doctor said, well, I think you better get a change, move out of town, give her a change.
Did she have a respiratory problem? Or was it
mental.
Oh, okay, fine. She needed to change the scene.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
She went over to the Ford Hospital and they did everything they could for her.
Yeah.
Couldn't do much.
Yeah.
So when the offer came from the Dracula Company in Cincinnati,
okay.
I took it.
Now tell me about that offer.
Well, Mr. Drackett, as I say, he had built a soybean plant and he wanted to get into more basic soy processing. When he heard that
Why was he interested in soybeans?
Well,
he's a chemical manufacturer.
Yeah. Well, at Brakeman and Drano, but that's just mix. All that is nothing but mixing.
Mixing
a compound. Yeah, there's no processing in it.
Okay, then he had he invented Windex by this time?
Yeah.
And he had, as you said earlier, an embarrassing amount of profits, and he was a public spirited gentleman.
He was.
And what did he want? And so he looked around and he found that the soybean would fit his.
And it looked like it had a very good future. And of course it did.
Commercial and possibilities were infinite, yeah, as it turned out.
So he came up and made this offer. And
how did he have, well, of course he knew about your national,
yeah,
attention that you got.
Actually, he had sent his research man up
to observe
CRs, and I got to know him quite well.
Oh, good.
And
what was his name? Do you remember?
Dr. Gangloff.
How do you spell that?
Gangloff.
Okay.
Very competent.
He was a PhD professor, PhD in chemistry.
I think so.
Okay, fine.
He was a doctor.
Okay.
And anyway, when the offer came from Mr. Drackett, I took it because I wanted to get my wife out of Detroit.
Was that R.J. Drackett, did you say?
H.R.
H.R. Drackett.
Mm-hmm. And I could see that we weren't going to be able to carry on the work with the Air Force after us and all the rest.
Right.
So I submitted my resignation. I think it was just before Edsel died, really.
Oh, just before Edsel died.
And then I left, I think I gave him a month or something then.
So in effect, you really made up your mind.
I had committed
before the project was given the axe.
No, because I can remember dismantling some of the equipment.
Oh.
It had already stopped,
mm-hmm,
and I remember walking through the building and seeing this equipment being dismantled.
Do you think the pressure of the wartime activities of the company were such that Mr. Ford had less and less time to think about your project in the
Yeah, with Edsel's condition, you know, he decided to step back in and run the company, and he became president again. Didn't he?
But you said you made the decision to retire before Edsel died.
Well, yeah, but we knew he was very ill, and Mr. Ford was very upset.
And it seemed terminal.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. So you've decided to leave the project. Was Mr. Ford sad that you decided to pull out?
I think so. I never saw him after I told Mr. Campbell I was leaving.
Oh, really?
But he wrote me letters,
uh-huh,
and called up, had Campbell call up several times, said, "How are you doing?"
In Cincinnati?
And, yeah.
Okay.
And invited me back and all that.
Uh-huh.
Which I didn't go, and I went back for his funeral. That's the last time.
I see. So from the time you decided you left and you decided to tell Mr. Campbell that you were leaving, you gave him a month's notice.
I think that's about it.
Uh-huh. And what did Mr. Campbell say when you said you were leaving? Did he?
Well, nothing he could say. I don't recall anything outstanding.
Was he sympathetic with the efforts you were making over the last 12 years?
Well, he said it sounds like a good opportunity for you.
Because
a lot more money and so forth.
Right.
So he.
By this time, were you? Did you have academic credentials in chemistry, or were you pretty?
No.
Much?
No.
Okay. Good. But Mr. Drackett knew of your.
He knew the whole story. Yeah.
And he wanted your research experience more than any sort of academic degree. Yeah. Good. Okay. So there you are in Cincinnati, and what type of projects does he have you working on?
Well, we took the fiber plant. He bought that equipment.
Oh, he did? He bought the whole
equipment.
Oh, he did.
And we set it up there in Cincinnati.
And I think you mentioned you took some of your staff with you.
Yeah.
That you could get to come that weren't of draft age or weren't being drafted or whatever. Or hadn't
been. Hadn't been, anyway.
Hadn't been drafted, okay.
I know. I was a 3A, I guess. That
mm-hmm. Right.
Come.
And so what sort of projects is he continuing? In a sense, your soybean reduction extraction.
Who? You mean Drackett?
Mr. Drackett.
Well, he died, and
what year did he die?
1949, I think it was. 40.
Well, you're moving about 6 years here.
I spent about 5 or 6 years there.
Okay. What? Supposing I say, okay, you're with the Drackett company under his benevolent Aegis, what sort of projects are you working on? What sort of research project? Or research and practical extraction project?
Well, we were working on the fiber. We set that equipment up.
You were making more?
Making more fiber and trying to develop markets for it.
Had you licked the problem of, what was the problem you had?
Well, we always wanted more wet strength.
Wet strength, okay. In case you were caught out in the rain.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
We didn't want your pants to break open at the knees.
Right, exactly.
We did develop this relationship with the Hatt Corporation, though, and we sold them a lot of fiber.
That was extended.
Yeah, we sold them a lot of fiber, and we decided to build a bigger plant.
Ah, in Cincinnati.
Which we did.
Uh-huh.
But that means we had to build a protein plant, too.
A what?
A protein plant in order to make the fiber.
Okay, fine.
Which
you mean I say the protein?
Yeah,
okay.
And we built it big enough.
In the preliminary discussions about the design of the plastic car, the exterior design, was as I understand from Mr. Overly, was the design, the fledgling design department, which occupied the south end of the engineering laboratory, Mr. Zerline space, were they consulted on a preliminary design proposal?
To the best of my recollection, very little contact we had with them. I remember talking with Gregory several times,
mm-hmm.
but I'm trying to think of who actually might have made the first clay model.
Mm-hmm. You mean of the design department's proposal?
Yeah.
Okay.
It could well be that they made the first clay model, and then we took it over and refined it ourselves.
But Mr. Ford did not particularly, or you, or Mr. Ford, or Mr. Overly, or whoever, did not particularly like their first design, and you either redid it or refined it.
Well, I'm hazy on that.
Uh-huh.
My first recollection of a clay model was in our laboratory down in the village.
That you and Mr. Overly worked.
Yeah, because
mm-hmm.
that's fun work.
I'll bet it was, yeah.
We enjoyed playing with the clay.
Good.
But we actually made a clay model, and we had it on that table there where Mr. Ford always sat, and discussed it with him. And of course, we were conscious of trying to keep the undercut and contour shape as simple as possible.
Of course.
And we knew the limitations of our plastic technology, whereas Gregory and his group did not.
And so they really did. They came up with something far more sophisticated, perhaps.
That's
really
possible.
Wanted.
Yeah, it could well be.
The photographs of the model showing you and Mr. Overly and Mr. Ford looking was it a 3/8 scale, roughly?
I think so.
Which was the standard scale mm-hmm. model at that time. It looks remarkably close to the finished product. Does it not?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think you must have, I suspect that Mr. Ford must have said, that's it, that's what we want. Apparently you had taken either made your own clay model or taken the design department clay model and refined it and reshaped it,
yeah.
One or the other, or both. Did you do several scale clay models? Or just
mm-hmm. We worked sure quite a while on that.
But you didn't. You didn't make a full-size clay?
No, oh no.
Just the scale. Unless you have anything further to say, I want to clear that up. Fine. So we're back in Cincinnati. Mr. Drackett is enthusiastic about your soybean isolation, and you find that you need a much larger building. Because of why? For what reason?
Well, we've felt that there was a big future in soy protein, just mm-hmm. as such, that it could be used in many things.
Right.
And so we decided to build a larger plant than we needed just to supply our fiber operation.
Uh-huh.
So we figured we'd have some to sell. We also had a big plastics operation down there. We built a plant for high impact plastic, not structural, but high impact.
Now what give us an example, please. Something that would be hit by a projectile?
Yeah, something that could absorb a heavy blow
without
shattering or breaking.
Right.
And I can't think of what the finished products would be right now, but we built a plant especially for this structural plastic. And as it turned out, it did not require soybean, finally. We thought it was wood at first that would use some protein, but...
But you had an experience with the instability of the soybean.
Yeah, we had a hard time getting the water resistance to the point where we wanted it. But all of these projects were pretty big operations for the Drackett Company, which wasn't really all that big.
They
had a lot of money, but they weren't...
They hadn't really expanded that heavily.
No. And actually, the rest of the management were market people, knew how to market Windex and Drano, and did a wonderful job.
But they had,
no feeling for the soybean operation. And when he died, they decided to move out, and they sold the plant, the whole soybean plant, to Archer Daniels.
But before he died, you were coming up with saleable products.
Oh yeah, we had.
And but
business.
You couldn't find the marketing or the advertising promotional people to push it.
Oh no,
in the wartime market.
We were making money on the plastics and the fiber.
Now, what sort of products were you turning on that are recognizable products? Or were you making bulk?
We were making the bulk plastic material, which we would sell to other molders.
Okay.
Who would mold it into the whatever finished product they
were. So you were selling bulk plastic, what was the composition of your most successful mold?
Again, this was phenol formaldehyde plus fiber that
still pretty much the heavy fiber.
Still pretty much the basic.
Flax, Ramey, others.
Yeah.
It was I was thinking of corn stalks, but no, that wouldn't.
No. I think probably the hemp was
the best.
Okay. Cheapest.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that was available this time.
Yeah,
Right. But your division was making money, your section was making money.
We expected when we finally got the fiber plant going that it would be quite profitable.
This is just after the war, probably.
Before
the war.
Well, we were still in a war psychology.
Oh, okay. Good. Did you supply plastics to industries that were making war material? Or didn't you follow it that closely?
We didn't hit the market at Drackett until after the war was over.
Okay, with your saleable bulk plastic.
Yeah. We were building the plant before then, but we didn't actually have anything to sell until after the war.
But obviously, the plastics industry just literally exploded after the end of World War II, when all restrictions were off, and the sky was the limit.
Right.
Yeah. So you expected a rather bright future for that division.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Mr. Drackett was also enthusiastic.
Oh yeah, he supported
and gung-ho about moving ahead, expanding. And then suddenly he died.
Right.
And that was another trauma.
Oh yeah, that really changed that company around.
None of the family took over? His son said?
He had a son in it, but he was not interested in
He was not interested
in chemistry. Now, he was a Harvard Business School graduate, and
you were making a profit.
Yeah, but he was more interested in making a profit with Windex and Drano. And products of that type.
Yeah.
We had a lot of research work going on new grocery store type products.
So
Archer Daniels came along and bought the plant.
Now, who is Roger Daniels?
Archer Daniels.
Oh, Archer, I'm sorry. Who was Archer Daniels?
They were one of the first soybean processors in the country.
Were they?
Oh, yeah.
Where were they located?
Their home office is Minneapolis, but they have a big operation in Decatur, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And
they were largely foodstuffs.
Food and just fabric, bulk oil.
Bulk oil, okay. Mm-hmm. So, but they weren't interested in the plastic, or were they?
No, they weren't really.
They just wanted your soybean reduction machinery and expertise.
They were sold, or they believed that there was a future in soy protein.
Oh, I see. And they were going to be on the foodstuffs.
And this could be either industrial. In that time, industrial paper coating was a big deal.
Oh, really?
Yeah. All of these slick magazines are now using soy protein.
Were they then?
Partly is
beginning. It was growing. Okay, that's interesting.
We had a color problem. We had to it was slightly off-white, and some of the fancy magazines wanted it dead white.
Dead white.
It took us a few years to sell that.
They were giving them an oyster. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But
how'd you sell it?
Bleaching compounds.
Oh, bleaching. Technically. Okay.
But Archer Daniels finally closed that plant down and then sold it to another company, Central Soya, who used it just for their storage. We had a million bushel storage elevator there.
You're going a bit fast for me. What did Archer Daniels propose that they take you along?
No, I had not. This
you
was
were
that,
not part of the package.
I left Drackett right after Mr. Drackett died.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I could see what was going to happen. They were going to.
You knew that the son was not interested in plastics. He just wanted to sell Drino.
That's right. So I left and went out on this edible fiber deal of mine.
Yes.
Where I owned the patents. And
but you had the patent and you felt there was a definite future for that.
Yeah.
Now, edible by humans and or animals?
Well, by humans, it's automatically, if you get it good enough for humans, it's good enough for an animal.
Of course. I'm sorry. But I would think the animals would be less discerning, perhaps.
That's right.
Yeah.
But they don't pay much money for animal feed.
Forgive me, of course. So what type of human edible products were you proposing to make out of this soybean?
Well, my idea, which really occurred to me, we're still up at Dearborn with our fiber plant.
Uh-huh.
I'll have to explain it.
Yes.
One of our operations, when we spun the fiber, we went through an acid bath, and then we had to go through a washing process.
Right.
And we used.
What did the acid bath do?
We dissolved the protein first and made a liquid solution out of it.
Right.
We call that our spinning dope.
Uh-huh.
And we pumped that through a spinneret or a die with a lot of little holes in it,
uh-huh.
which was immersed in this acid.
What type of acid?
Well, in edible acid, in edible plants, it's vinegar.
Okay, that's acetic acid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in industrial protein, it would be
less
sulfuric.
Stronger. Yeah, oh, sulfuric.
But okay. You couldn't do that with edible.
Right, yeah.
So as these streamlets of protein were coagulating in the acid,
okay.
We'd lead it through the bath about 36 inches, and it would be fully coagulated, and then we'd take it over reels, and then through washing.
I've seen those photographs, yes.
Through the washing deals.
Uh-huh. And some light?
Okay, and it was necessary for us to get all of this acid and the salt or two out of the fiber, and in order to determine that, we could analyze it chemically, but it would take several hours. So the easiest way was to taste it, and we'd take this fiber as it was coming out of our washing machine, and you could tell if you'd washed it thoroughly or not.
By the taste?
Yeah, you can taste.
Or by the consistency?
Taste.
No.
You can tell if it's salty or not. And or if it's sour, it'd be tangy.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that, though. Why would it be sour or tangy?
If we didn't wash it thoroughly.
Enough of the acidity.
It'd be carried over, you see.
Okay, yeah, okay. The vinegar,
it turned out to be quite a difficult washing job.
Uh-huh.
For edible.
Yeah.
We had to get rid of it all.
Yeah.
And one day I was sitting there chewing on it.
You're doing a lot of taste testing.
And it suddenly occurred to me, he said, well, what the hell? If we can make a fiber from soy protein that will resemble the outside of a sheep, why not make a fiber that will resemble the inside? In other words, an edible fiber.
Huh?
Up to that point, all of our thoughts and efforts had been inedible fiber, wool, that sort of thing.
Now, inedible means not digestible, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Had you ever swallowed any of this stuff? Eaten it like
no, because it was terrible.
Yeah,
too tough, for one thing.
Okay. Oh, it was too tough?
Sure.
Oh, okay.
Because it had gone through formaldehyde and everything else.
Of course.
And to make an edible fiber, you wouldn't dare go through formaldehyde.
Right.
But anyway, it occurred to me, if we can do that for outside, let's do it on the inside. Well, the idea sounded too far-fetched, and
you kept in the back of your mind.
I never could get it out of my mind. I never
did
really
you ever
could.
Approach it to Mr. Ford?
Yeah.
What did he say?
No, I didn't.
Never did?
No. He, well, things were falling apart by that time.
Of course, yeah.
So I never got around to that.
That was on the
I'm just sorry that he wasn't around to really work on that idea because it was
right up his
it was right up his alley.
Right, exactly.
Perfect. So that idea bugged me.
Let me ask you one question before I forget. Back to the plastic car, and the word formaldehyde reminded me again. There was a contemporary observation that it was a great idea, and it was certainly earth-shaking, but that it had one drawback. It smelled like a mortuary. Because of the formaldehyde, was that true?
That's possible.
You couldn't get rid of the formaldehyde.
We could if we wanted to. We didn't.
Oh, you didn't.
We just didn't spend any time on it. We could have done that.
Okay, good. Please.
But on, we had enough free formaldehyde around that car that you could smell it.
So you've mastered the, or at least you're beginning to master the process of an edible protein.
Well, no, we really didn't start building an edible protein plant until I got down to Cincinnati.
Right.
Before we'd never
That's right.
tried even.
Yeah.
But when we got down there,
you broached Mr. Drackett.
Yeah.
And what did he say?
Well, he said that looks pretty good.
Yeah.
But
was he fairly adaptable, flexible to innovative ideas like this? At least
yeah.
In the early
stages. Yeah, he was a very educated and well.
Good.
Well, to train me up.
Good.
But we never really did anything with an edible fiber at Drackett. We had this industrial plant going and took all of our efforts
uh-huh.
to work that one out.
Uh-huh. You never really got it going?
Well, we didn't try.
Before you died. Oh, I see.
We spent all of our efforts on industrial protein.
Of course, yes, and that was where the profits were at that time.
Right.
Good.
But after I left Drackett, I decided to investigate the real possibilities of an edible fiber and checked all the patents. I had patent lawyers check over the literature for me and everything, and I could find nothing.
Really?
Nothing in the way of an edible fiber. In Germany, there had been ersatz hamburgers, which were
right, during the war.
Which were
so
terrible.
Sawdust, weren't they?
Yeah.
Sawdust were
pretty much
impregnated with animal blood and
right.
and whatever.
So, I applied for a patent.
Back to the Italians. Hadn't they tumbled to the fact that the casein was edible? And
oh, of course,
whey,
the casein was the basis for cheese.
Right, and encouraged the whey.
But they weren't trying. They were trying to make synthetic wool too.
Yes, right.
That's where they figured the market and the money was.
I see. Okay, good.
Nobody had ever really seriously or done anything about
have
an edible fiber.
As the person who really came up with this?
It's a benchmark pioneer patent in the patent
is.
Office.
Oh, great. Okay.
Never, absolutely no prior art, which is almost unheard of.
Absolutely no what?
Prior art.
That's a patent office
term.
Phrase.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good.
Just nothing.
No provenance. It came out of your fertile imagination?
That's right.
That's great. Yeah.
So, we were still, as I said a minute ago, in a war psychology.
Right.
So I made a prototype in my own basement of a pork chop.
You mixed it up in the basement.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I took that out to a company that was then trying to spin a corn protein fiber, corn gluten. This was Virginia Carolina Chemical Company.
Protein gluten?
Yeah, it's
corn
from corn.
Gluten. Yeah, okay.
And they said they weren't interested, or they weren't able to tackle this new project, but they were very interested. And they would let me use their pilot plant if I provided my own supplies and equipment.
And where was that?
This was in Taftville, Connecticut.
Taftville?
Mm-hmm. They'd taken an old textile plant and remodeled it.
Uh-huh.
And were trying to spin a corn protein fiber. So I took them up on it, and I went up there and took some of my own protein and spun my own edible fiber.
Using a centrifuge effect, or how did you do it?
Yeah,
you're talking about the spinning.
Yeah.
Oh, of course, yeah, I'm sorry.
And I made enough fiber so that I could make ham and prototype stuff, which I then took to various food companies to see if I could sell the idea.
Right.
And I did.
You did?
Yeah. The first company I went to was, well, they were tied in with the Taftville. Corn Products Company produced the gluten that the Taftville people were spinning. Okay. And they were interested in that process. So when I showed them these food samples made out of soy protein, they said, well, can you do that out of corn protein? So I said, I don't know, I'll have to try it. And they said, well, all right, we'll give you a research
contract
for 6 months to see what we can do with it, because we want to sell corn gluten. And so for 6 months I worked with Corn Product, but we never could get rid of the disagreeable flavor of corn protein. It's
really?
too raw.
Oh, is it?
So then I have
covered up with sugar.
Yeah, well, it comes through.
Okay.
You can even smell it when you drive through a field of corn growing. You can smell it.
Very, very strong.
So I was still on my own and running out of money.
As a
consultant. Yeah.
Consultant, yeah.
So I decided to go up to Chicago to the meat people, and if they weren't interested, then I was going to drop it and just forget it.
Swift Armor.
So I went up to Swift. Showed them a couple of samples, and within half an hour or half a day, they said, we're going to give you a letter of intent. We want this. So they did.
A financial letter.
A letter of intent. And so they...
It was like a credit.
Yeah. Uh-huh. They didn't want me to go to Armor across the street.
Oh, you went to Swift first.
Yeah, I went to Swift first.
Okay.
And I never got out of there.
That's marvelous. Well, wait a minute. Back up a bit. What had you fashioned for them that they were so entranced with?
Well, I tried to make something look like a pork chop.
Yes, which you'd made in your basement.
Yeah, and I smoked some and colored it pink so it looked like ham.
What about taste?
Well, it wasn't bad.
Well, how did you make the taste come up?
Well, you get hydrolyzed vegetable protein, which is a meat type flavor.
Now, tell us a little bit about that. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Has that been? You didn't come up with that.
No, that's old stuff. Yeah.
But what has they been using hydrolyzed vegetable protein for?
Oh, bouillon cubes and that kind of stuff.
Which you mean to say that was they would take the beef essence and then use the vegetable protein
vehicle for the bouillon cube?
When they say hydrolyzed, it means that they boiled the soy protein or vegetable protein.
Yeah.
Partially broke it down, and it develops flavors when you do that.
What would be the vegetable that they normally would use?
Well, of course, the Chinese use soy.
Yes.
In this country, they're using wheat.
Mm.
And soy both.
Mm-hmm.
But
so you use that to
give it a meat-like flavor, and then I put smoke and of course spices.
Oh, what kind of spices?
Oh, anything. In the ham, I use cloves and that sort of thing that you normally
simulate the baked ham.
Yeah, that's
that.
Right.
Okay, and of course you have the pink color. Mm-hmm.
And the thing that appealed to Swift was that I had no idea what I was doing. it reminded them of Thuringer sausage, which is
a ham derivative.
Well, it's a meat derivative. It's a sausage type of product that's fermented.
Or something made of ham.
But I think it's a mixture of meats, but it's fermented.
Oh.
And it develops a very nice flavor.
Pungent
and it's very popular in Germany.
Pungent, yeah. Flavor, yeah.
And it's very expensive to make.
With a large German population in this country.
This is one of their first thoughts where they could use this idea. And also, Swift had just come through a traumatic experience. They had turned down the invention of hot dog casings, the cellophane casings.
You mean the natural intestinal casing?
Not the natural, but they turned down the idea of producing this out of cellulose.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that turned out to be a very, very big improvement in the meat industry. The Visking Corporation then developed it and became
corporation?
V-I-S-K-I-N-G, I think.
K-I-N-Z?
G.
G.
Visking.
Yeah, okay.
And Swift had lost out on it.
You mean all the non-natural casing frankfurters are encased with this cellulose cover.
Right.
An edible cellulose cover.
It's not edible. They have to cut it off after they cook the hot dog.
Really?
Yeah. Natural casings they can leave on.
Well, what about the so-called non-natural casing hot dog? You know, in other words,
The edible, you mean?
The kind that do not pop when you eat it.
I don't know what you mean by that, but...
As I suspect, all natural casein Frankfurt, all Frankfurts were natural casein at one time, right?
Yeah, right.
And today, they're in the minority. You get
right.
the other kind.
That's right.
But what is the casein used on that?
Cellophane.
An edible cellophane, right?
Yeah. Well, it's not edible. They have to cut it off after they cook it.
You don't see this.
No, you never get it.
Okay. Oh, it's
you
like couldn't,
you can't chew it.
It's like an extrusion, really.
It is. It's an extruded tube.
Okay, good. All yep. right. Great. And, fine.
But they have to cut it off after the hot dog's all cooked.
Okay, great.
And, but it's very successful. All the hot dogs today are...
90% of them.
Swift makes 10 million, or at that time, we were making 10 million pounds of hot dogs
and
a day.
And they had turned down
and they had
the
turned
venture?
This down.
Who was that, you know?
No, I don't know. But
who did he take it to? Did he take it to Armour across the street? I
don't know how they formed this present company, which had a had the monopoly for several years.
What was the name of the company again?
I think it was Visking.
Visking. Yeah. Okay, good.
Yeah. Anyway, Swift was they didn't want to
lose
a, so they didn't let me out of there that first day until
they signed you
a letter
right
of intent.
Away. Uh-huh.
And then we developed a contract, and they took an option under my patent. And I agreed to work with them 25% of my time, showing them how to spin the fiber, and then I hoping their chemists then could go on and develop final products.
Now, obviously, they're thinking of a subsidiary line, a vegetable meat product, a vegetable imitation meat products that would complement their natural meat products, right?
Well, it was in conflict. That's what finally stopped it.
Now, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg is doing this out in Battle Creek, isn't he? This time.
Not spun fiber.
No, but he's doing soy.
He made soy patties.
Soy loins, they call them. Yeah. Soy burgers. Okay, but that's not what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Yeah.
That didn't have the fiber structure that meat has.
Right. Okay. Good. Oh, you were actually able to simulate the
fiber
structure
sure.
of a piece of steak.
That's right.
Okay, great. All right. It wasn't mushy.
No.
Okay.
You can make it
great.
Chewy.
Okay. Chewy.
Yeah, like
right.
like a steak.
Right. Okay. Good.
And research contract call. I agreed to give them 25% of my time. And then
you're still a freelance consultant.
It's Swift, yeah.
At Swift.
But I wasn't on a payroll.
Right. Okay.
And then I contacted the Unilever people in England.
And who are they?
Well,
UNILEVER.
Yeah.
They're a large.
They own Lever Brothers here and Lipton Soup.
Soaps and soups.
They're next to General Motors in size.
Right.
Worldwide.
Okay. But they have a lot of consumer
everything.
Products.
Everything.
Okay.
They're very large.
Yes. Uh-huh.
They took a license under my patent.
They're a British holding company.
Yeah, and Dutch too.
And Dutch, okay, yeah.
And
they
so
took a license on which patent? I'm sorry.
My edible fiber.
Okay, yeah. They shared it with Swift.
Well, they wanted the foreign rights. Swift had
the
U.S.,
rights.
Canada, and Mexico.
You signed those away in your letter of intent.
While I had the option.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And Unilever took the rest of the world.
Good heavens, that's incredible.
I was filing patents like mad all the time. It costs money. But they finally agreed to pay for the patent costs. Unilever did. Because they figured it was so important. That
now, what were they going to do with it?
They wanted to do it out of peanut protein.
Oh, my God. Now, of course, there had been some work with Carver, Dr. Carver and others, who was another Ford favorite in peanut utility. But it's probably mushroomed after he died and after the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But Unilever had taken a contract from the, I don't know what government, whether it was English or what, but to go down to Africa and manage a million acres to produce peanuts. They call them groundnuts.
Where in Africa?
It's on the west coast somewhere.
Okay.
They grow a lot of peanuts down there even now.
Do they? The climate is conducive for
it. Yeah, but they don't know how to do it. I mean, their technology is terrible.
Oh.
So Unilever agreed to manage that.
Uh-huh.
So they wanted to find outlets for peanut products too.
Right.
So they took a license from me, and I agreed to spend 25% of my time over there.
Uh-huh.
And we built a pilot plant to spin fiber from peanuts over there.
Unilever is footing the whole bill.
plus your...
Well, I was Swift. Swift was paying royalties too.
Okay, all right. Oh, they get in the peanut process as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, well, no, Unilever didn't confine theirs to peanut, but that was what their intent was.
Oh.
But they left it open. They could use any protein they wanted.
Okay, fine.
But peanut was where their commitment was.
Okay.
And so for 3 years, I spent one quarter of my time over in England.
Working with the Unilever.
Working with the Unilever.
Yeah, research
right.
arm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So then I came back and...
Did you enjoy that?
Very much. They're wonderful people.
You made a lot of great contacts with their research scientists,
yeah.
And you were contributing quite a bit of mm-hmm. in terms of expertise.
Well, then I came back and General Foods took an option. And they didn't confine it to any protein, but it was subservient to Swift's license.
They had to share that.
Yeah. And then Nabisco took a license from me. And
are you getting royalties, by the way,
I was all this time? General Foods made a yearly payment. Just.
But I mean from Unilever and Swift?
Oh, yeah.
You're getting patent royalties.
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
but, yeah.
They were each paying $20,000 a year.
Great.
You know, from nothing to that.
That's not your consulting fee. That's great.
That's licensing fee.
Okay, good. But you're also getting consulting fees as well.
Yeah, well, 20%. Mostly expenses, really.
Oh, okay.
And then General Mills took the license, and then finally Ralston Purina took all remaining rights. And
you mean they bought them? Wait a minute. General Mills is sharing it with Swift.
Swift dropped their...